podcasting technology of normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. It is Tuesday, July the 3rd. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal. Get patriotic this week and make sure your fellow Americans don't fall prey to senseless marijuana prohibition. Join Normal today at norml.org. It won't get legalized without you. Join up today, again, at normal.org. Got a great audio stash for you today. Tomorrow, 4th of July, we're going to have a special program with lots of music. We did that last year, had a great show. So a big music program for the 4th of July tomorrow here on the audio stash. Today, we've got a regular Government at Work segment. We're going to speak with Rena Sapansky of the Drug Policy Alliance of New Mexico. They're just putting into place some of New Mexico's medical marijuana law, which comes into full effect on October 1st. Also on the program today, we'll speak with LA's dopest attorney, Allison Margolin. She joins us today to talk about her experience in law school, her practice in Los Angeles, and some cannabis cases she's encountered there. So let's open up our stash right away with our Government at Work segment. Today on Government at Work, we're going to take a look at New Mexico's medical marijuana law due to come into full effect on October 1st. New Mexico passed a medical marijuana law that was championed by Governor and presidential candidate Bill Richardson this year, making it the 12th state to offer legal medical access and the 4th state to enact medical marijuana legislatively. Joining us today is the director of the Drug Policy Alliance of New Mexico, Rena Sapansky. She's worked very hard to bring this legislation into law. Rena, welcome back here to the Audio Stash today.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Wonderful to speak with you today, Rena. Now, the New Mexico law has earned a lot of media this week. Tell us what's happening there right now.
Well, actually, the first official day that the temporary cards are being issued was July 1st, so basically, people are submitting their applications to the Department of Health to get their temporary ID cards to be patients and caregivers under the law.
And how many people have submitted applications in these first few days? Has there been a big response?
You know what? I know there's been a lot of calls. We've been getting a lot of calls here at the office, too. I'm not sure how many applications they've received as of right now, but certainly people have been downloading the applications, and a lot of folks will need to get them signed by their doctor and then submit them. So I think people are doing that this week as well.
Now, have you been fielding questions from physicians there as well?
You know, we've put together some materials for physicians because there's a lot of confusion, I think, amongst medical providers about what this bill means and what their requirements are under the law and that kind of thing. So we're available to answer questions from medical providers because I think there is a bit of confusion.
And how about the New Mexico State Department of Health, who are really instrumental in how all of this works? How have they been responding to all this?
You know, they have been so supportive. Of course, they also were very supportive of the bill during the legislative session, but they really have kept the spirit of the campaign going in that they are thinking about the patients and putting the patients first. Of course, they're thinking about safety and security and, you know, what's going to be administratively best for the system and for the state. But also, I mean, I really, really have to give them a lot of congratulations and kudos for really thinking about the patients and what they need, and they have a lot of experience with dealing with patients with some of these very serious illnesses, and so they understand what it means to be a medical marijuana patient or what it means to be in pain, and I think they really are putting together a program that's going to really honor that and get the patients what they need as much as possible within the law.
Righto. And Rena, there are a number of well-known cancer centers in New Mexico. Have they responded in any way that their patients will now have access to this new therapy?
A lot of support coming out of the HIV/AIDS community. They definitely, I think that folks living with cancer have certainly been contacting our office. We've heard from a lot of them. So I think it's going to be interesting for the cancer centers to see how many of their patients do need this and what percentage really could benefit. We've had such strong support from the HIV/AIDS community, though, and I know that a lot of the providers who treat people with HIV or AIDS are rejoicing and are really, really pleased that they can offer some legal protection to their patients.
We're with Rena Sapansky, the director of the Drug Policy Alliance of New Mexico. We have links to them online at normalaudiostash.com. Rena, a lot of the media this week about the New Mexico program has a focus on the supply side. You know, what is so unique about that aspect of the New Mexico law?
Well, you know, again, this has been a very patient-centered movement, and the number one issue in all of the other states is where do you get medical marijuana? Yes, you're protected from arrest, but if you can't grow your own, if you don't know someone who's a supplier or a source, where do you go and what do you do? And it's really, really difficult when you're living with a really serious, debilitating medical condition, and then on top of that, you don't know where your medicine's going to come from. I mean, that's really complicated. And so that was the reason why we put that language in, that we wanted the state to license, to regulate the production and the distribution of medical marijuana in the state. But we're the first state in the country to have that provision. And so we're pushing the envelope. And it's very, in a lot of ways, I think the response from the press has been very positive because people understand what we're trying to do. We're trying to take medical marijuana out of the black market, regulate it, make sure it's high quality, make sure it's good for patients, and get them access. And that's a really admirable goal. Whether we can do that and whether the federal government will allow the state to do that is another question. And so although I hope that the federal government is not going to waste its time and money going after a state that's trying to do the right thing and trying to cut drug dealers out of the solution for medical marijuana, whether they're going to do that or not, I don't know.
I know one of the suggestions is for nonprofits to cultivate the medical marijuana, but would the state at some point be distributing the marijuana to patients directly?
You know, there's a lot of possibilities. I mean, I think we don't even know what the production system is going to look like either. So whether it's nonprofit or whether it's centralized or whether it's actually the state, I mean, there's a lot of questions about that. There's a significant amount of legal analysis that has to go on. So there's a lot of unknowns, and we're not going to really know what direction the department's going in until they release the first draft of the permanent regulations, which will happen sometime this summer. Those will go into effect as of October 1st. And so that will be sort of the guiding template for the program over the next couple of years. But, you know, I also think that a phased-in approach could be very helpful. And so right now they're working on they're getting the ID card system seamless and working on that, you know, to experiment with some different forms of regulation of different entities who may be able to produce and distribute. I think that that could be helpful to phase in some different entities over the next few years. So I don't know. I mean, ultimately it's the department's decision, and they're doing their own legal analyses and that kind of thing as well. So there's a lot that's up in the air, but at least we know that they are very committed to getting the patients access, which I think is just wonderful.
And what will those medical marijuana cards actually look like there in New Mexico? I know it varies state to state, from, you know, a simple piece of paper to a laminated license-looking card.
Yeah, I don't think that – I'm not sure if the I actually haven't heard if the they're going to have photos on them or not. That was being debated as of a couple weeks ago. But I think they're going to be pretty standard, pretty simple. It's not going to be – you know, this incredibly complicated thing like a passport or anything like that. But, you know, they also want to make sure that they can prevent counterfeit type of things as well. So they've looked at some models from Colorado and Montana, and a couple of other states have been very helpful to our Department of Health in terms of sharing with them, you know, well, this is the ID card machine we use, this is the program. I don't know. The first card will be given to one of our patient advocates, and so that's when we'll see what it actually looks like.
And, Rena, what about the rules that are being put together right now to come in line with that October 1st start date? Who's actually writing all of the rules for the program right now?
It's the Department of Health, their Office of General Counsel, in consultation with the Infectious Disease Bureau of the Department of Health. So the program is going to be centered in the Infectious Disease Bureau, but, you know, the Office of General Counsel, which is the Department of Health's attorneys, basically, they generally draft regulations and that kind of thing. The Division of Health Improvement has also been involved, and so it's been pretty collaborative at the Department of Health. And when they put out the regulations, there will be a period for public comment, and I think that they are planning too, and hopefully we'll be able to have some town hall meetings even before the regulations are released. So we can imagine in the next couple months a couple of town hall meetings in some various locations in New Mexico. The regulations will be released, and then there will be a public hearing at which people can come and provide testimony, either written or oral, to the department commenting on the regulations that have been put out. And then the department has a certain amount of time to put out the regulation for final publication, and then they would go into effect October 1st. So there's a lot of stuff that have to happen in the next few months before October 1st in order to get the regulations in place.
Righto. Arena, thank you again for joining us here today on the Audio Stash. I look forward to talking with you more about the New Mexico program here very soon in the near future.
Thank you, Chris.
Rena Sapansky is the director of the Drug Policy Alliance of New Mexico. She and patient advocates were instrumental in getting New Mexico's medical marijuana legislation passed this year. We have links to the Drug Policy Alliance and New Mexico's office at normalaudiostash.com. You can find them online at drugpolicy.org.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
You in the war zone. THX. I wanna go universal one time, mate. I wanna talk to the whole world, mate. Cause I know niggas feel this shit, man. Anywhere, man. No matter where you at, you gotta feel this, cub. Trip. If you see the police,
don't stop.
You got your heat on the seat.
Don't stop.
My nigga, get your cash.
Don't stop.
Oh, you keep the stash in the dash.
Don't stop.
Oh, you like to scrape and crawl.
Don't stop.
Well, we do it with no breaks at all.
Don't stop.
Okay. Yeah.
Joining us today here on the Audio Stash is attorney Allison Margolin. You can find her online at AllisonMargolin.com. We have links to her site at NormalAudioStash.com as well. Allison bills herself as LA's dopest attorney and focuses on prohibition violations. Her father is Bruce Margolin, who's run the West Hollywood chapter of Normal for some years. Allison grew up in the Beverly Hills area and attended law school at Columbia and Harvard universities. She's fresh into her career as a practicing attorney, but has already gained a fair amount of media attention in the LA area and worked on some interesting cannabis cases. Allison, welcome here to the Audio Stash today.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Great to speak with you today, Allison. Now, first, tell us what made you decide to pursue law as a career.
Well, when I was young, I was always debating between being a journalist and being a lawyer. And I like to write, but at the same time, from a very early age, I was aware of the medical marijuana and the just marijuana legalization issues with my dad. Obviously, he was the head of Normal. And my mom was also a criminal defense lawyer when I was very young, and later on moved on to other things. But it wasn't just my dad, but kind of my whole family had a very liberal consciousness. So I debated for a while, you know, what should I do? Should I pursue journalism, and can I make more change to being a journalist, or should I be a lawyer? And then ultimately I concluded that I'd like to kind of be in the mix as opposed to writing about the mix, and that I could become a journalist afterwards, and I could just do legal journalism. So I guess it was just my intellectual upbringing and then my desire to kind of be in the forefront rather than writing about it.
I know you wrote for the Harvard Law Record for some time, sort of combining those two interests.
Yeah, I wrote for the Harvard Law Record and I wrote for the Columbia newspaper. And now I maintain a blog where I write about legal issues and I do videos about legal issues. And I recently wrote an article in a local paper about Paris Hilton sentencing and about drug law, that type of stuff. So I'm very happy that I've been able to still do that.
And what was your college experience like at those two schools?
You know, I got into Harvard by writing an essay on legalizing drugs. So that obviously showed me that they were, you know, the intellectuals were kind of hip to that idea and to the righteousness of it. But going to law school, it was a very, like, alcohol type of place. People weren't stoners. They were just drinking. You know, I guess that's what people do in Boston. And I was a very eccentric person compared to them. And I come from being at Columbia where I was, like, mainstream. And so to come to Harvard and be eccentric kind of made me feel like an outcast. But I did get support for my views in my classes. And in particular, I had this class called Food and Drug Law. And the professor was this guy named Peter Barton Hutt, who was the chief counsel for the Food and Drug Administration back in the day. And he let me do my thesis for Harvard on the right to get high, which was a constitutional argument for doing drugs. And the right to do drugs, all drugs. And interestingly enough, Rick Doblin, you know, the head of NAFTA, also took that class and started his works in that class also. So that made me feel supported, but the actual student body was not, they were afraid politically to probably embrace me or my ideas.
Let's talk more about that constitutional argument, Allison. You know, could marijuana be seen as a civil right?
Well, I think it really is. I think that we have the right to free speech, and that underlying predicated on that is the right to alter our consciousness in order to, you know, speak freely. And so I think it is a right that underlies our constitutional rights. And I think one day it will be accepted. I think that first probably is, you know, striking down the enforcement of the Schedule I status of marijuana. And then after that, it will open the door, I think, a little bit. Once people see that, you know, people aren't running around recklessly smoking marijuana, it will open the door and the consciousness of the country to that idea. And I think one day it will prevail. It's only been, like, about 100 years that drugs have been illegal federally, you know, since, like, the 1909 FDA Act. And so it's not that this has been like this forever, although I think that people don't have a real social history that, it's all, you know, they think that this is how it's always been, but realistically it's been 100 years, so I think there's hope.
Now, you've opened your practice in Los Angeles. You've got print, radio, and web ads that bill you as LA's dopest attorney. You talk about cannabis openly and have also taken to specialize in these prohibition violations. So what made you want to pursue this area in particular, and, you know, is this area of criminal defense more difficult, perhaps?
Well, for me it's tough because my dad is obviously a very prominent you know, marijuana lawyer, criminal defense lawyer. So in the beginning, I worked for him for a while, and then I left his practice, and, you know, I wanted to do mostly this type of work, but I had to deal with people acting like I was just, you know, copying him, etc. But basically, this had been, you know, I wouldn't have done this if this wasn't my calling, because it was kind of difficult in a social type of way, and just in terms of having my dad be, like, a prominent person in this area. But it was because this is, like, it is my calling, and I feel it very strongly, that I wanted to focus on victimless crimes. It was difficult in terms of just coming from, you know, my dad to do it, but I think ultimately I started to prove myself, and now it's not a problem.
Allison, we've seen a number of women in the legal profession really gain a significant amount of notoriety working in the area of criminal defense. Do you think this type of law is a place where women can really become very powerful within the legal profession?
Well, I actually agree, but it's probably for different reasons. It's because, interestingly enough, before I became a lawyer, I was always a nerd. Like, everyone knew me at Harvard as a person who admitted to studying all the time, and at Columbia I studied all the time. And then once I became a lawyer, other lawyers and, like, courtroom people actually assumed that I wasn't that smart because, you know, I have somewhat of a style in the courtroom. Like, you know, I dress cute, you know, I dress my age, whatever. So it made me more powerful because I felt people, like, oftentimes would underestimate me to the point of, you know, not preparing like they should for trials and not basically just not being prepared because they felt that I was going to be easy to overcome. So I guess in that way it's been, you know, I've been able to use my femininity and being a woman to help myself. But it wasn't something I thought of originally. It's something that just came to me after seeing people's reactions to me. So it's because of that I feel that, yeah, being a woman is put you in a strong position just because of the chauvinism I discovered, which I never even thought existed before I became a lawyer. I thought that people who talked about, you know, chauvinist workplace, and even my mom when she would talk about, you know, the way men sometimes treated women lawyers, I thought, oh, come on, how could that be? That wasn't my experience. But then once I became a lawyer, I realized it was, but I was able to fortunately, you know, utilize that to basically, you know, get ahead of the men.
Now let's talk about some of the cases you've seen or encountered. Many outside of California may think of it as this paradise for medical marijuana cultivation, but that's not necessarily true.
It's not the case at all. Unfortunately, because of the laws, you know, being as they are, that you can have up to 8 ounces of medical marijuana, unless your doctor says you can have more, that's not even a reality in terms of law enforcement, because if you have over an ounce and any amount of money on you, and you're not obviously dying of a serious illness, the police will arrest you just like they'll arrest anybody. And the problem is that people have become more conspicuous in their usage, you know, driving around more with marijuana and cultivating in the open. I had one client who was cultivating, you know, 20-foot plants in his backyard in Compton, thinking, you know, like he had all the, you know, he had gotten a growing certificate from San Francisco, he had his recommendations, he was growing for other people, and obviously the police sent helicopters above him, arrested him, and ultimately had to go to trial, and fortunately won that case. But even in places that are full of crime and serious and violent crime, like Compton, they still want to get people for marijuana, and it's crazy. And they're very vindictive about it. Even in, like, the one of the more trafficky types of courthouses in downtown L.A., they have a very hard stance against medical marijuana, and they will prosecute people to the fullest extent. And even for small amounts, I have a guy with 10 grams of marijuana. He had $1,000 on him. He's being prosecuted. And it's insane use of resources. And especially in a city that is, you know, has kind of a lot of violent crime and serious crime, it's really shocking.
And Allison, is there perhaps a chip on the shoulder of law enforcement there in California? Because medical marijuana is so accessible there, that law enforcement and judges even may feel the need to bring the law down as harshly as possible on those they can and do arrest.
I do think so. They have, a lot of times DAs, they say to me, oh, this doctor gives recommendations all the time, and people don't really have serious illnesses, and they're doing it as a front for X, Y, or Z, and they're somehow personally offended by this. This one prosecutor told me my client had committed a fraud with people of California by obtaining a medical marijuana recommendation. And it's really hard for me to understand how they can become passionate about prosecuting marijuana cases. I think maybe they're just irritated by the fact that people now can, you know, get off for using marijuana. But it's really unconscionable to me that they could have an issue like that. Especially from my view, I think all use is medical use. You know, if recreational use is maybe, if somebody doesn't have a medical problem or doing it recreationally, so to speak, I think that's just people becoming more spiritual and getting in touch with their spirituality. And I can't understand how any use could really be impermissible, especially when our society has medicalized so many different problems, like, you know, Viagra, obviously, they suggest taking Xanax for social anxiety. I can't really understand how prosecutors can then suggest that people shouldn't be using medical marijuana. And I say to them, oh, would you prefer a Sistrin, a Vicodin, or a Xanax? And they're like, well, maybe. But it's obviously just that they're so unfamiliar with the effects of these prescription drugs that they can have this idiotic and unrealistic stance.
And what are some of the most common cases at your practice there?
Well, the most common cases are cultivation cases or transportation of any amount of marijuana. But generally, with the cultivation cases, either we win them outright, or the only deal that I'll accept on one of those cases, depending on, you know, other issues involving the client. Like, for example, if the client is in school, he can't even take a less than an ounce as a misdemeanor as a disposition because it will affect his ability to get a student loan. But barring those issues and, you know, considering the strength of our defense, the worst scenario on most cases I'll accept is a misdemeanor more than an ounce or a misdemeanor less than an ounce. But ultimately, I do win a lot of them. But it takes a lot of time. Like, these cases go on from 6 months to a year, and I usually don't win until I'm in the trial court ready to go to trial, and finally the DA dismisses the case. Sometimes we do win at preliminary hearing, and that's when the judge is, you know, understands the law, and that's obviously a great thing. But unfortunately, it usually is right before trial, and you're already into this for months and months and months. And but usually we are successful. At least the courts and the juries, you know, are told the law. And the jury instruction is very helpful to us, which if a prosecutor is willing to listen to you, they'll realize that all you have to do is raise a reasonable doubt that it's for medical purposes. Most affirmative defenses, like self-defense, if it's like a murder case, you have to raise a preponderance of the evidence, which is about 51% likelihood that, you know, you actually defended yourself. With medical marijuana, all you have to do is raise a reasonable doubt. So ultimately, you know, it's not too difficult to win, but it doesn't mean it's not stressful. You know, like, I have a cultivation case tomorrow, which is ridiculous, but it's still always stressful to go to jury trial. And, you know, you can at least voir dire the jury about their views on medical marijuana, get rid of the people who are obviously biased against it. But, you know, you have your heart in your mouth every time someone could go to prison potentially for cultivating for medical use. It's very scary.
Let's talk about those juries for a moment. When you encounter members of the public in California coming on for jury duty, do they seem pretty knowledgeable about medical marijuana and the laws surrounding it there, or is there still some problem with misinformation?
They seem very sophisticated, you know, but I guess it depends on the way, you know, what the strength is of the prosecutor and how he peppers the case. If it's just me asking questions, for example, you know, did you vote for the medical marijuana law? Even if you didn't vote for it, could you still uphold the law if you find that this person cultivated for medical use? Then it's easy for me to figure out, you know, who's against it and who's for it. And usually people are pretty, they don't seem to, I've only had to go to jury trial once on this kind of case, and tomorrow will be my second one. But in the other case, one guy testified who was, my client was growing for a collective, he was one of the members, and he testified he actually smoked 60 joints a day. And I asked the jury afterwards whether or not they found that believable, and they didn't seem like to be an issue at all to them. So I think they're receptive about marijuana. They realize the, you know, kind of lack of severity of that type of crime.
And what's the most intense case you've had to deal with so far?
Well, one of the most intense cases is kind of a well-known case. It's Stephanie Landa, who was convicted of growing 1,000 plants in San Francisco with two co-defendants. Unfortunately, in her case, she had gone up to San Francisco thinking that, as it advertised itself to be, it was a sanctuary from the federal government. And she even had gone to a meeting of the police where they told people, if you're going to grow, this is what you should do. And they used licensed contractors, et cetera. And ultimately, the San Francisco Police Department raided her grow and turned over the evidence to the feds. And she's now in prison. We're actually filed over to the U.S. Supreme Court over it, but she's in prison right now over growing 1,000 plants or a little less than that in San Francisco. And what Mike Britt argued is that as long as the feds can continue to prosecute cases in the medical marijuana states, you know, the state law really isn't being respected. And that's for two reasons. One is that there's no bar against the states turning over evidence to the feds where the city won't prosecute, which happens, unfortunately, quite a bit. And secondly, because of existence of the federal prosecution, people in their state cases are having trouble getting, for example, dispensaries to come forward and testify to them. Assuming, let's say, this person is growing as part of a collective for a dispensary, and they get busted, and you say, okay, what were you growing for? And they say X and Y dispensary. well, this dispensary may or may not want to, you know, come forward. Their lawyers will definitely tell them don't do it, you know, because they have the federal prosecution hanging there over their head. So the state law has made things, you know, a little bit better for people, but at the same time, they really can't truly exercise their rights as the state law is supposed to be executed.
Now, attorneys in Los Angeles do gain a level of celebrity on their own, and you've certainly gotten some media attention out there recently. You know, what do you think of that?
Well, I feel that if I can use, you know, myself or the visualization of myself or my personality to convince more people about the moral wrong of the criminalization of marijuana and, you know, the criminalization of victimless crimes, other ones like prostitution, gambling, etc., I feel that I can maybe, you know, convince more people towards my position, and that's really what I hope to do, you know, in addition to being able to get better and better cases. But it's like, the celebrity aspect on its own is not really what I'm going for. I'm going for that as a vehicle to really affect social change and to get people attracted to me, whatever, visually or through my website or whatever it is, or even through my advertisements, and then somehow they'll be more hip and more open to seeing things my way. So I hope that it comes out that way.
We're with Allison Margolin, who bills herself as LA's dopest attorney. You can find her online at AllisonMargolin.com. We have links to her website, MySpace page, at NormalAudioStash.com. Allison, you know, as you pursue cannabis law in California, is there some sense that because so many patients and cultivators continue to be arrested, that might spur a renewed push from California for broader federal legalization of marijuana overall?
Well, I think that it's possible. I mean, when I talk to law enforcement, they actually believe that they are following the federal law and that it's their obligation to arrest people even for small quantities, and that the courts can decide, you know, whether or not they have a defense. Yet at the same time, most people I talk to that are, you know, on law enforcement side or even district attorneys believe that marijuana should just be legal. And I think as there's more exposure of actually this, what we're talking about, that people still are getting prosecuted, and that there's never going to be, you know, they're never going to stop prosecuting people for medical marijuana as long as the plant continues to be criminalized. So I think as there's more exposure of the reality of the criminal system and the numbers of people and prevalence of people being prosecuted, hopefully there can be some other referendum on the ballot to change things. But the problem, of course, is that as long as the federal law remains as it is, police and law enforcement are going to believe that they need to follow it. And so even if we legalized it on the state level, they would start turning more cases over to the feds. So really it needs to be, you know, completely descheduled or put into a Schedule 2, Schedule 3 on the federal level in order to really make a big change.
And is there a generational shift happening right now, more young people getting involved with cannabis law change, perhaps being more active than the baby boomer generation on this topic?
Well, I hope so, but, you know, the problem, of course, is that people are still reluctant to admit that they're marijuana users in a large part, and so it hurts the ability of, you know, the interest getting pushed forward. When I was in college, I did my thesis on why the legalization movement hasn't succeeded more. And one part that's interesting is that most interest groups are composed of the people who, you know, have that interest, like people who are advocate legalization marijuana, you know, would be the people who smoke. But because it's still somewhat stigmatized in so many communities, you know, people don't want to admit that until people start really admitting it and voting on that issue. You know, it's not, I don't think it's really going to get anywhere. So I guess maybe though as it becomes more socially accepted and more people are affected by the criminalization, more families, you know, see their people going to jail and prison for this type of thing, then things will move forward. And I guess in an ironic way, the prevalence of the prosecutions is going to help that because so many more people are, you know, affected by it.
And is it also that marijuana, even with criminal cases surrounding prohibition, don't get much media attention, you know, compared to, say, Paris Hilton going to jail for a suspended license? You know, is that also an issue right now?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason, like, I feel like using my, you know, kind of pushing the celebrity thing and getting attention through my website and stuff is helpful because, yeah, people, like, are interested in seeing who they're interested in seeing. So I think it is sad, but it is true that, you know, something like Paris might get more attention than Tommy. That's really sick, but that's why I try to do things the way I do them. Hopefully I can kind of get the attention, even if it's not the right way of getting attention, and utilize that attention to make people see the issues.
Righto. Allison, this has been a great conversation here today. I really appreciate you taking time to join us here on the Audio Stash.
Definitely. I really appreciate being on here and being able to share these kinds of things with people. Thank you.
Thank you again. Allison Margolin is an attorney in Los Angeles. She bills herself as LA's dopest attorney. You can find her online at AllisonMargolin.com. We have links to her website, MySpace page, on our own at NormalAudioStash.com. Distillers with City of Angels there, and we started off our interview with Allison Margolin with Snoop Dogg, Don't Stop. That's on the digital release and the Independent Online Distribution Alliance, Get Low Digital Records from Snoop Dogg. The album is called Mandatory Hyphy Volume 1. Got links to all the music we play on our website. Check it out at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's NormalAudioStash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow.